You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Holiday 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Vanishing by Nathaniel Rich. Their wallets were empty. Far more likely is the narrative of Jerry, the royal F-up. In this version of the story, scams beget scams, and incompetence snowballs into recklessness and squander. The public bid was a last-ditch effort to salvage a flailing Ponzi, exploiting positive press and public sympathy to bilk money from investors. We now know that Cotton began, no later than 2015, to steal his clients' funds. He also created dozens of false trading accounts to stimulate trading volume on the platform, a fact he even disclosed in the 2015 filings. He neglected to disclose, however, that he filled those fake accounts with invented funds, trading counterfeit Bitcoin for real Bitcoin and Canadian-American dollars. By the time of his death, Cotton's sham trading accounts, which had names like R2-D2 and C-3PO, had conducted approximately 300,000 trades. After the public bid failed, he kept no internal records, an almost inconceivable state of affairs for a company with an annual trading volume of more than $1 billion. In Ernst & Young's phrase, one imagines its battalion of stern accountants in various shades of apoplexy, typical segregation of duties and basic external controls did not appear to exist. Most years, Cotton neglected to file a personal tax return. When he did file, he claimed no income from Quadriga. Cotton provided withdrawals manually, seeming to give preference to the customers who complained loudest in public forums. He sent cash in paper bags and shoeboxes to coffee shops, laundromats, and pool halls. He also accepted cash deposits. A year before his death, he sent a colleague a photograph taken in the kitchen of his Kelowna home. On the polished granite island are a vase of pink roses, the discarded lid of an ice cream carton, a copy of National Geographic, and dozens of dictionary-thick rubber-banded stacks of Canadian currency in crisp 20s, 50s, and 100s. Still, Cotton was not directly responsible for all of his troubles. Because Canadian banks refused to accept cryptocurrency business as clients, Quadriga had to rely on third-party processors, which levied outrageous fees and, in some cases, stole funds outright. One Quadriga contractor claims today that the payment processor WB21, now the subject of federal lawsuits in the United States, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom, stole $14 million, and that another processor stole $5.8 million. Patron Jennifer Robertson and at least a couple of other Quadriga contractors each operated their own payment processing firms, a significant conflict of interest, though not illegal. There was also the $21 million seized by CIBC and the software glitch, which cost Quadriga $14 million overnight. Despite all this, Quadriga should have had about $200 million of its customers' funds in its cold wallets, the external hard drives disconnected from the internet that functioned like bank vaults. But within a month after Cotton's reported death, blockchain investigators proved that nearly all of the inaccessible wallets were empty. Cotton, it turned out, had transferred the funds into personal accounts on competitor exchanges. At least some of those accounts had also been emptied. The operator of an exchange on which Cotton opened accounts told Ernst & Young that Cotton had squandered most of his holdings on reckless trades. On one particular margin account, he conducted 67,000 individual trades alone, placing enormous bets on fledgling currencies like Dogecoin, Omisco, and Zcash. In 2014, Cotton spoke publicly of moving currencies between exchanges to take advantage of arbitrage opportunities. It may be that he traded Quadriga's funds in a frantic effort to recoup the losses he had sustained. It was the behavior of a doomed gambler employing the martingale strategy, successfully doubling down in a desperate effort to get back to zero until he had dug a hole so deep that he could only be buried inside it. After he squandered what remained in Quadriga's coffers, the price of Bitcoin plunged, and there was a run on the exchange. Then he flew to India, where things managed to get even worse. The honeymoon. There is yet another possibility, one that none of the case's investigators is willing to discount. Call it the mastermind theory. It begins with a few findings that do not fit neatly into the royal F-up narrative. Cotton had mentioned having a safe bolted to the rafters in the attic of his home, in which he had stored the passwords to his various cryptocurrency accounts. After learning of his death, one of his contractors immediately went to the house and searched for it. He found the place in the attic where four holes had been drilled through the rafters, but the safe was gone. Eric Schletz, the pilot who brokered Cotton's purchase of the Cessna 400, has described having seen Cotton walking through an airport with $50,000 in cash. There were rumors of other employees taking similar trips. Perhaps Cotton's obsessive foreign travel, he boasted of having visited more than 50 countries without ever having been searched by customs, was inspired not by wanderlust, but by strategy. In this way, Cotton could have stowed away a fortune in foreign bank accounts in preparation for a grand exit. What if the furious trading on other exchanges near the end of his life was not careless, but calculated? This is a question that the lead investigator for the FBI's cybercrime division, Jennifer Vanderveer, has posed to crypto experts. It is theoretically possible to conduct high-volume trades in such a way as to launder funds, provided that the trades are exotic enough to ensure that the losses accrue to another account that Cotton or an associate controls. Cotton's trades were so bizarre and so risky that this seemed plausible. Just as plausible, perhaps, as the idea that Cotton believed a series of Hail Mary bets on Zcash would come through. The RCMP and the FBI have refused to comment, but some of their interview subjects have gotten the impression that they believe Cotton might not be dead. They asked me about 20 times if he was alive, says one witness who has intimate knowledge of Quadriga's workings and has been questioned by both agencies. They always end our conversations with that question. QCXINT, the creditor and blockchain expert, said that the FBI's Vanderveer told him that with hundreds of millions of dollars missing and no body, it's an open question. The only way to verify that the body Robertson brought home from India was Cotton is to exhume it. The RCMP, which has jurisdiction over the case, has thus far not done so. For his part, Patron says he hasn't seen any reason to think that Cotton is alive. Under the mastermind theory, Cotton ran Quadriga much as he had S&S Investments and its successors, honoring enough withdrawal requests to maintain credibility. The plan from the beginning would be to keep the con going as long as possible before vanishing with the money. After Bitcoin collapsed and the withdrawal complaints turned into lawsuits, negative press, and the threat of a formal investigation, Cotton got married, wrote a will, flew to India for his honeymoon, and disappeared. If the mastermind theory seems far-fetched, it's worth pointing out that an exit scam can only succeed if it seems far-fetched. Cotton built his career on the insight that most people are willing to believe most of what they are told most of the time. Jerry, the mastermind, would count on the world, believing he was reckless, greedy, and dead. He would count on most people to forget all about him. Most people, a year after his death, already have. In October, Robertson signed a settlement in the Quadriga bankruptcy case, agreeing to forfeit approximately $12 million Canadian dollars of assets to the creditor class. In a statement released by her lawyer, she said she had no knowledge of Cotton's improper business practices and was upset and disappointed when she learned of them through the investigation. She expressed a desire to move on with the next chapter of my life. She may have to change her name one more time in order to do so. If Jerry the mastermind is alive, what is he doing? He would have new names and passports, perhaps a new face. He might still be collaborating with Patron, or Patron might be trying to track him down in a final act of con versus con. Cotton may be hoping Robertson will join him once all the investigations have concluded, or she may be just another one of his victims. He might be living on a private island, or in Hong Kong, Thailand, or Monaco, traveling by yacht and helicopter and private jet. He might even be eating cheeseburgers and drinking beer. Jerry, the mastermind, might think he will get away with it. And he will, as long as everyone else believes he hasn't. The Boy Who Cried Work by Gabriel Sherman. Adam and Rebecca Newman grew WeWork to a $47 billion valuation by convincing mentors like Masayoshi Son and Jamie Dimon, along with much of Wall Street, that he had a near mystical understanding of the working style of millennials. Then, on the eve of its IPO, people realized it was just a real estate company. Inside the crash of a unicorn. On the afternoon of September 18, 2019, WeWork co-founder Adam Newman was working out of his 6,000-square-foot Gilded Age triplex off Gramercy Park when he got a text alert on his iPhone. The Wall Street Journal had just published an explosive article chronicling what it said was his reckless management of the co-working startup, the era's preeminent unicorn. Newman is dyslexic, and reading is a challenge, so advisors quickly briefed him on the story's most troubling details. Vivid accounts of his heavy drinking, marijuana use, and habit of making grandiose pronouncements, like wanting to be elected president of the world, live forever, and become humanity's first trillionaire. The article could not have arrived at a more perilous moment. 2 days earlier, the We company, WeWork's parent, announced that it was delaying its IPO after investors universally rejected the offering. Even when WeWork slashed the valuation by 75% to between $10 and $12 billion. In the run-up, a string of high-profile executives had walked out the door, including the chief communications officer, the co-head of the firm's real estate fund, and the global head of real estate partnerships. Just weeks earlier, WeWork had been privately valued at $47 billion, which was $10 billion more than the market capitalization of Ford and double the GDP of Iceland. Now, unless WeWork secured a new source of emergency funding, it would run out of cash before Thanksgiving. Next photo, Street of Dreams. WeWork co-founders Adam and Rebecca Newman in Brooklyn, 2016. Adam Newman said his descendants would still be running the company in 300 years. For an embattled CEO running a company on life support, being the subject of a takedown by the business paper of record would mean instant career death. But Newman characteristically assured colleagues that the article was not much more than a speed bump. He controlled 65% of the stock and had the power to fire the board of directors if the board moved against him. So confident was Newman of his job security that he once declared during a company meeting that his descendants would be running WeWork in 300 years. WeWork executives had long grown accustomed to Newman's belief that the laws of economics, even reality itself, didn't apply to him. It was in the nature of unicorns that they bent reality, and that certainly had been true of WeWork. Fueled by $12 billion of venture capital and debt, Newman grew WeWork in less than a decade from a single co-working outpost in Soho into a 12,500-employee company with 500,000 users in 111 cities across 29 countries. But in 2018, WeWork had lost $2 billion and had a highly questionable business model. The company signed long-term leases and sublet space to freelancers and corporations on a short-term basis. Its valuation somehow kept rising. The company's valuation put Newman's net worth at $4.1 billion, and his spending more than kept pace. It was succession craziness, a colleague said. Newman was chauffeured around in a $100,000-plus Maybach sedan and traveled the world on a $60 million Gulfstream G650. As reported in the Wall Street Journal, he and his wife, Rebecca Paltrow Newman, Gwyneth's first cousin, spent $90 million on a collection of six homes that included the Gramercy condo, a 60-acre estate in Westchester County, a pair of Hamptons houses, and a $21 million mansion in the Bay Area that features a room shaped like a guitar. They employed a squadron of nannies for their five children, two personal assistants, and a chef. Adam went through money like water, a former executive said. In a way, the spending made sense, because Newman himself was the product. He pitched himself to investors as a gatekeeper to the rising generation. A new way of working, a new way of living. Work was 24/7, co-workers were friends, office was home, work was life. For baby boomers who experienced office life as cubicles and bad coffee, his message was irresistible. Every investor who walked through was sold, a WeWork executive told me. They saw Newman as a millennial prophet who did shots of Don Julio during meetings while preaching about the dawn of a new corporate culture, one in which the beer and kombucha flowed and MacBook-toting employees would love coming to work. After sitting with Newman in his office, outfitted with a Peloton bike, infrared sauna, and cold water plunge, Steve Jobs biographer Walter Isaacson told Fast Company that Newman reminded him of the Apple co-founder. Newman later told colleagues that Isaacson might write his biography. Isaacson did not respond to a request for comment. Through a combination of egomaniacal glamour and millennial mysticism, the Newmans sold WeWork not merely as a real estate play. It wasn't even a tech company, though he said it should be valued as such. It was a movement, complete with its own catechisms. What is your superpower was one. Adam said WeWork existed to elevate the world's consciousness. The company would allow people to make a life and not just a living. It was even capable of solving the world's thorniest problems. Last summer, some WeWork executives were shocked to discover Newman was working on Jared Kushner's Mideast peace effort. According to two sources, Newman assigned WeWork's director of development, Ronnie Behar, to hire an advertising firm to produce a slick video for Kushner that would showcase what an economically transformed West Bank and Gaza would look like. Behar told me he only advised on the video and no WeWork resources were used. Kushner showed a version of the video during his speech at the White House's peace conference in Bahrain last summer. To a passel of geezer capitalist, this was too big to miss, even if they didn't fully understand it. Possibly not understanding it was the point. Rupert Murdoch, Sir Martin Sorrell, and Larry Silverstein all took meetings. Mort Zuckerman, the billionaire co-founder of developer Boston Properties, told a real estate executive shortly after WeWork launched that Newman was creating the future of work. Zuckerman soon offered to buy WeWork for $500 million. Newman declined the deal, but accepted a $2 million investment from Zuckerman. Adam was probably the best salesman of all time, a former WeWork executive told me. In April 2012, Newman secured his first venture capital funding from Benchmark Capital, the San Francisco-based firm famous for its bets on eBay, Twitter, and Uber. Benchmark co-founder Bruce Dunleavy joined WeWork's board after touring a WeWork with Newman. Bruce walked in and he said, "You're not selling co-working, you're selling an energy I've never felt," recalled a former WeWork executive who attended the meeting. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon was also an evangelist. In 2018, J.P. Morgan led a $700 million bond offering for WeWork. The bank extended Newman nearly $100 million in loans and was among a group of banks that provided Newman with a $500 million personal credit line. Newman told an executive that Dimon was his personal banker and might leave J.P. Morgan to run Newman's family investment office one day. A source close to Diamond said that Diamond had no plans to leave J.P. Morgan. Newman's most fervent believer, though, was Masayoshi Masa-son, the 62-year-old CEO of Japan's SoftBank Group. In recent years, Masa had transformed SoftBank from a telecom conglomerate into the world's most aggressive startup investor, doing more than anyone to inflate the unicorn bubble. Backed by $60 billion from Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi, SoftBank pumped billions into fast-growing but money-losing companies like Uber, DoorDash, and Slack. Masa would invest $10 billion in WeWork. Adam later said, "I'm crazy, but Masa is crazier," a former WeWork executive recalled. Reality came crashing down last August when WeWork filed its S-1 prospectus to go public. Investors were shocked by WeWork's spiraling losses and that the company had spent millions on Newman vanity projects, such as a wave pool company and a startup that sold turmeric coffee creamer. Most damaging, however, were disclosures that Newman made $6 million by selling the Wii trademark back to the company and held ownership stakes in buildings WeWork leased from, essentially paying himself. After criticism, Newman returned the trademark money. He gave his wife a large role in choosing his successor. Next, photos, global open plan. For Newman, millennial work began with interior design. Culver City, California, 2019. 85 Broad Street, New York City, 2019. 32nd Milestone, Gurugram, India, 2019. Linehouse, Shanghai, 2017. Number 1 Poultry Building, London, 2018. Linehouse, Shanghai, 2019. And cash and carry, SoftBank's Masayoshi Son, who infused WeWork with more than $10 billion in Tokyo, 2018. Suddenly, the Pasha lifestyle that made Newman an avatar of the new economy seemed like something else. Millennial entitlement gone insane. A collapsing unicorn bends reality the other way. When he was on the rise, everyone painted the most beautiful picture. On the way down, they only wanted to show the most ugly picture. Sam Bin Abraham, a Newman friend and early WeWork investor, told me. Newman began hearing from WeWork's bankers that Wall Street viewed him as toxic, a person who spoke with Newman told me. Looking for advice, he called Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi and texted Travis Kalanick, who had been forced from Uber in 2017 amid a flurry of allegations of discrimination and sexual harassment. Newman retained lawyers from the white shoe firm Paul Weiss and PR advisors from Edelman to set up a war room. On Friday, September 20th, Newman arrived at WeWork's headquarters vowing to fight for his job. "I'm never not going to be CEO," he told a colleague. One of Newman's favorite words is optionality, but he was rapidly running out of them. In the wake of the Journal expose, investor Michael Eisenberg and WeWork CFO Artie Minson held a conference call with WeWork's directors and argued that Newman had to step down, two people briefed on the call said. On Sunday afternoon, he met with Diamond at J.P. Morgan's headquarters. Diamond made it clear that WeWork would never be able to secure fresh capital as long as Newman remained CEO. And while Diamond didn't say it, the subtext was clear. WeWork was barreling toward bankruptcy, and Newman would be unable to repay the $380 million he borrowed against the value of his now potentially worthless stock. 2 days later, Newman resigned. Newman's fall is one of the most spectacular flameouts in recent corporate history, an Icarus story for its time. Though in Newman's case, he floated down under a golden parachute. When SoftBank bailed out, we work on October 22nd for $9.5 billion. Newman walked away with a package that included $1 billion in stock, $500 million in credit to pay back loans, and a $185 million consulting fee. The money, though, didn't blunt the confusion and anger he was experiencing, people who spoke with Newman said. In the weeks after losing control of his company, he became paranoid that he was being followed. He heard a rumor from a reporter that one of his investors hired the Israeli private intelligence firm Black Cube, the same firm Harvey Weinstein used to track Ronan Farrow, to dig up dirt on him to force him out as CEO. Mainly, he holed up in his Gramercy condo, trying to piece together what had gone so disastrously wrong. Not long after Newman started WeWork in 2010, the then 31-year-old Israeli entrepreneur showed up at a real estate industry conference on Park Avenue wearing his now familiar uniform, T-shirt, and jeans with shoulder-length surfer hair that looked like it hadn't been washed in days. Newman, who is 6'5" and shares model good looks with his sister, a former Miss Teen Israel, was an instant object of fascination among the suit-clad executives, many of whom were twice his age. They were taken with his exotic backstory. He was raised on a kibbutz in southern Israel, not far from the Gaza Strip. But it was his hyper-confidence that one attendee most recalled. I remember Adam asked me what company leases the most office space in New York. I told him J.P. Morgan. They have about 3.5 million square feet. And he said, well, I'm going to lease more than they do. It was a delusional idea at the time. Newman was a college dropout with no commercial real estate experience and a business track record of having launched two failed startups. A company that sold women's shoes with a collapsible heel and a line of baby clothes called crawlers that featured pants with knee pads sewn into the legs. When the financial crisis hit in 2008, Newman had burned through an investment from his grandmother of nearly $100,000 and scrambled to hire a lawyer to renew his visa to stay in the country. To help pay rent, he let another company sublet space in Crawler's Brooklyn loft. It was the genesis of the WeWork idea. In the post-crash recession, Newman had the foresight to bet landlords would need tenants, and that legions of underemployed professionals would pay for an appealing alternative to working from a Starbucks while they got back on their feet. Newman partnered with a laconic 34-year-old architect named Miguel McKelvey, who grew up on an Oregon commune, and together they convinced Crawler's landlord to let them convert an unused floor into a shared workspace called Green Desk. The concept did well. A little over a year later, they sold it to the landlord at a reported $3 million valuation and struck out on their own. Newman envisioned WeWork as a capitalist kibbutz, where members would work, eat, and drink together. McKelvey designed WeWork branches that fostered community by keeping hallways narrow and packing in open desk to encourage spontaneous encounters. After hours, members participated in yoga classes, wine tastings, and networking panels. Next photo, Culture Clash. Co-founder and Chief Culture Officer Miguel McKelvey in Shanghai, 2018. The WeWork aesthetic evoked a cross between a Silicon Valley startup and a boutique hotel lobby. Offices had clean lines, Danish furniture, no leather or plastic utensils allowed, and neon signs on the walls with phrases like hustle harder. By 2018, Newman's improbable boast had come true. WeWork surpassed J.P. Morgan to become New York's largest private office tenant, with some 5 million square feet of office leases spread across more than 50 locations in the city. Achieving this blistering growth, resulted in barely controlled chaos inside the company. The place made the Trump White House look like a well-oiled machine, a former senior executive said. At WeWork's first headquarters in the financial district, there were twice as many employees as available desk in the early days. They scattered employees throughout WeWorks around the city, a former executive recalled. Newman had personally reviewed the first 100 leases, but as the company grew, it became a free-for-all. The company voraciously leased office space with seemingly little strategy except to keep adding locations. To entice new customers, WeWork offered members free rent and bought out their existing leases. We are in a consumption phase like nothing that has ever been seen, Newman declared at an industry conference in 2015. There was no discipline to how Adam approved leases, an executive said. A broker who worked with the company during this time recalled, "No one knew what anyone was doing." The torrid pace took a toll on morale. "We would joke that we worked like slaves," a former WeWork employee said. "Adam would have meetings on Sunday, and you could never miss those. And sometimes it wouldn't happen, or it'd happen hours late, and you'd be there all night. You'd cry in the bathroom all the time," the employee recalled. At the same time the company was burning money to expand, staffers were made to feel expendable. WeWork's previous CFO, Ariel Tiger, who served in the Israeli Navy with Newman, talked openly about firing people. Every 2 weeks, Ariel would get a printout of payroll, and he would go through and redline the shit out of it, saying he wanted to reduce people's pay, a former executive said. "I remember walking through the office, and Ariel would loudly say, 'Why do we have all these people? I could do what they're doing with two people.'" Everyone knew he was Adam's guy. Tiger did not respond to a request for comment. The promise of IPO riches kept many employees from simply quitting. The numbers they threw out at all hands meetings was that this is going to be a multi-billion dollar company, a former employee said. The money was only part of it, though. Newman inculcated in his post-collegiate staff a belief they were members of a vanguard changing the world, or at least a belief they may work in an office, but they didn't have to grow up. Employees were expected to attend Newman's weekly Thank God It's Monday parties and a roving annual retreat called Summer Camp, held in different years at an upstate New York compound and an English country estate. The events were one part TED Talk, quantum physicist Michael Brooks gave a lecture, and another part Animal House. Employees played beer pong and partied to performances by Florence and the Machine and Two Door Cinema Club. Until a few years ago, the Newmans were devout followers of Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical faith, and it infused WeWork's office culture. One employee said key meetings were often scheduled for the 18th of the month, because 18 is a sacred number in Kabbalah's 32 paths to wisdom. Adam encouraged senior WeWork executives to participate in weekly study sessions with his spiritual advisor at the time, Rabbi Eitan Yerdani. "It was a lot about finding your inner peace and purpose," an executive who attended the meetings recalled. Newman's charisma was intoxicating to be around. "If you had to go to war, you wanted him to be your general," a former executive said. "His sense of himself is beyond human," recalled another. Newman paraded through the office barefoot with celebrities like Drake and Ashton Kutcher and had an unnerving ability to maintain eye contact during conversation, lending him the aura of a guru. "When you're in a room with Adam, he can almost convince you of anything," a former employee said. Newman used mass gatherings to spread his gospel. "I think the thing that all of us know is that if you want to succeed in this world, you have to build something that has intention," he said on stage at summer camp in 2013, his hair pulled into a ponytail. "Every one of us is here because it has meaning. because we want to do something that actually makes the world a better place, and we want to make money doing it. The crowd of thousands exploded in cheers. So many of the people were young and had never worked in a real company. They bought all of it, a former senior executive said. I realized after I got there it was a cult. Newman's gravitational pull was drawing in the world's biggest investors, too. In the spring of 2016, Newman met Masayoshi Son at a dinner. The following year, Newman invited Masa to WeWork headquarters. Masa informed Newman he had precisely 12 minutes to hear a presentation. Afterward, Newman followed Masa outside to his car, hoping to continue the pitch. Masa told Newman he didn't think his business plan would work. Newman's problem was that he needed to think bigger. WeWork shouldn't just be leasing offices to small businesses. It should be leasing office space to all businesses. Masa scribbled on an iPad the number of SoftBank was prepared to invest, $4.4 billion. Adam dazzled Masa, an investment banker close to both men, told me. Pumped up by SoftBank's billions, Newman's messianism became more like megalomania. Adam's fantasy land became a reality, a former WeWork executive said. Newman sat down with world leaders, discussing the Syrian refugee crisis. Discussing the Syrian refugee crisis with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and urban planning with London Mayor Sadiq Khan. When Adam got in front of world leaders, it was like he started thinking he was one, a former executive said. In conversations with people inside and outside the company, Newman's pronouncements became wilder. He told one investor that he convinced Rahm Emanuel to run for president in 2020 on the WeWork agenda. Emanuel did not respond to a request for comment. Newman told colleagues that he was saving the women of Saudi Arabia by working with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to offer women coding classes, according to a source. In another meeting, Newman said three people were going to save the world: bin Salman, Jared Kushner, and Newman. Shortly after the news broke in October 2018 that Saudi agents tortured dissident and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and carved his body with a bone saw, likely an order from the Crown Prince himself, Newman told George W. Bush's former national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, that everything could be worked out if bin Salman had the right mentor. Confused, Hadley asked who that person might be, according to a source familiar with the meeting. Newman paused for a moment and said, "Me." Next photo after Adam. Marcello Klahr installed as executive chairman in October at the New York Stock Exchange, 2018. Rebecca Newman shared her husband's fervor that WeWork was a movement. From the second I met Adam, there was an energy between us that felt like it was larger than just the two of us, she told the Style website Couture. They married in 2008, the year Green Desk launched, and she took on the role of WeWork's raven-haired 5'9" first lady. Senior executives bristled at Rebecca's nebulous, free-ranging role and her thin resume. Prior to WeWork, she'd lived in Los Angeles, trying, unsuccessfully, to make it as an actress and screenwriter. After college, she spent a few weeks working on Wall Street before quitting, telling a friend the job wasn't for her. Executives wondered why the marketing consultant Jonathan Mildenhall, whom WeWork hired to help develop its brand, was also advising Rebecca on her personal image. He asked her questions like, "Are you a magician, maverick, or a muse?" said an executive who participated in the session. At company events, Rebecca interviewed luminaries like Lin-Manuel Miranda and Red Hot Chili Peppers frontman Anthony Kiedis. Crossing Rebecca had consequences. It didn't help that Newman was racing to find a financial lifeline as a darker side of his company was appearing in the papers. In October 2018, Ruby Anaya, WeWork's 33-year-old director of culture, sued the company, citing its entitled frat boy culture and claiming she had been fired after she reported to Human Resources that she had been sexually assaulted at a work event. The suit alleged that when Anaya walked off stage after presenting an award at a WeWork conference in January 2018, an intoxicated male employee forcibly kissed her. The lawsuit cited an earlier incident from summer camp in 2017 in which a drunk coworker allegedly groped her from behind. After both episodes, HR failed to discipline the men, the suit said. It was awful, Anaya told me when we met one afternoon last fall. I remember saying to HR, who has to say something for it to be believed? Rebecca, who is safe here? No one is safe. A WeWork spokesperson said, WeWork's new executive chairman, Marcello Clar, has made clear he will not tolerate behavior of the kind alleged in the lawsuit. A more immediate problem was the air the unicorn bubble was leaking fast. Uber shares debuted down nearly 10%. The whole world shifted, a senior WeWork executive said. Uber was a big part of it. The narrative of the unicorn was ending. Had we gotten out before that narrative shifted, we would have been fine. WeWork's failed IPO vaporized as much as $40 billion of shareholder value in 2 months, a unicorn extinction event, at least in the near term. It was comparable to the end of tulipomania. Those who are losing the most are WeWork's beleaguered staff, many of whom had small equity stakes. They'd believed deeply in Newman, worked insane hours, and bought in fully to the WeWork dream. They pushed the narrative that this is your family, and you're supposed to spend a lot of time with them. It was somewhat incestuous. It was like we were at war together, a former staffer said. The company's IPO, the blessed liquidity event, was part of their faith, built into their worldview. Now, thousands may lose their jobs, and any equity is a distant dream. It's hard to overstate their fury at Newman, who's walking away a billionaire. Recently, the New York Times reported a group of WeWork employees circulated an open letter calling Newman's payout graft. This company was designed and managed to make a handful of people ungodly wealthy at the expense of everyone, a former executive told me. But WeWork was a group delusion, and Newman is not the only guilty party. SoftBank deserves a lot of responsibility, a former WeWork executive told me. It's very difficult for anyone to control themselves if you have a sugar daddy like Masa. Newman is telling friends he took the fall for financial decisions WeWork's board of directors and his advisors had all approved. He complains that he never wanted to sell the We trademark back to the company, but WeWork lawyers told him he couldn't give it away for free, people familiar with the transaction said. WeWork didn't respond to a request for comment. He feels victimized by the media, and he insists the WeWork buildings he owned were actually money-losing investments. He bought them to prove the WeWork concept to skeptical landlords during the company's early days. Wall Street, too, deserves blame, he's told people. Just last spring, bankers from Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan were throwing themselves at him, trying to secure WeWork's IPO and the estimated $100 million in fees it would generate. Newman tells people Bankers told him that WeWork could be worth $90 billion. It wasn't strictly Newman's fault that investors no longer had the appetite for money-burning startups like Uber and Slack. WeWork's botched S-1 is Wall Street's fault, he told People. Why didn't the bankers and lawyers warn Newman the disclosures he put in the S-1 would spark an investor backlash, he asked his friends. Having once been a prophet, he now speaks of himself as a martyr, people close to him say. The more Newman stewed, the more he came to believe he was the target of a coup. Powerful interest wanted him out of the company, he tells friends. The crash of WeWork's IPO meant that investors who had pumped billions into WeWork were suddenly at risk of losing their shirts, and now they wanted to collect. Sources told me his prime suspect is Benchmark Capital. In 2017, Benchmark led a boardroom push that ousted Kalanick from Uber and later sued Kalanick to force him off Uber's board. Newman's suspicions of Benchmark increased when he learned that investor Michael Eisenberg, a Benchmark general partner, rallied WeWork board members to dump Newman after the delayed IPO, sources said. Eisenberg did not respond to a request for comment. For now, the Newman's dream is over. In September, the company announced it was getting rid of the Gulfstream and closing Rebecca's school. They withdrew all five of their kids. He tells friends he wants to learn from his crash. In his office, he keeps a card with three lessons he wrote. Listen, be on time, be a good partner. He thought about flying to Tokyo to see his one-time patron Masayoshi Son, but decided not to. He tried drafting a letter to WeWork employees, but as of mid-November, he hadn't figured out what to say. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.